The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Thanks to spiritmotorgroup.ie. With secure online payments, buying your next used car has never been easier. With Spirit Motor Group.
Now, you may have read that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, is facing trial on corruption charges. It might be, though, the least of his offences. Robert Fisk is on the line. Robert, good morning.
Good morning.
You've been writing about the situation in Israel, but before we talk about that and about, you know, choosing who we charge for what right across the Middle East, I just wanted to maybe bring a bit of good news from the Middle East, and that is the lower rate of COVID-19. It's quite dramatic, really.
Yes, I've noticed it, and I've talked to friends in the Middle East about this. I've talked to doctors, I've talked to a relative of mine who's actually a cancer surgeon, but who comes from the region and spotted the same phenomenon, and that is that in countries where we were constantly warned, and I think I was probably one of the warners too, that there would be a mass death through the pandemic of COVID-19, the refugee camps of Lebanon, the refugee camps of Syria, the refugee camps of southern Turkey, Yemen, and other nations who are at war or semi-war. This mass death has not apparently so far occurred. Now, we must pray that it doesn't. I don't want these warnings to be fulfilled. But so far, they have not. In Lebanon, for example, where there are mass Palestinian refugee camps and more, well over a million, if not a million and a half Syrian refugees, there have only been 26, it may be 28 now, but it was certainly 26 dead when I was last on the phone to Beirut. In Gaza, I think the figure is one dead, whereas in Israel, with all its extraordinary health hospitals and forward-looking medical centres, there have been well over 230 deaths so far. That doesn't mean that Israel's not behaved well under the COVID-19 lockdown, but it does raise the question of how it is that people living in such close proximity, where it's merely laughable to suggest that social distancing can exist, where masses of people live in hovels very close to each other, there has not been this mass outbreak which people fear. Now, Iran might be an exception. It's a pilgrim route, and it may well be that some countries are secretly burying their dead, but they can't do it on the scale of hiding it forever from the outside world. I know, for example, speaking to a friend of mine in Damascus, that he was chatting to a doctor in Deir ez-Zor, which is in the far east of Syria, who admitted to him that recently he's had a lot more death certificates to sign for civilians for respiratory problems as the cause of their death. So clearly COVID-19 is taking more lives than we know in the region. But up to now, it doesn't seem to be taking the number of lives that many people, including themselves, feared it would. And this is something that at some point we need to ask the question, why? I did put this to a surgeon in London who said to me that it may be because so many of the people of that region, there's such a huge proportion of people who are young, under the age of even 20 or 30, that the percentage of young people who are largely unaffected, if you look at the overall figures across the world, has meant that these countries have not suffered the same as Western, wealthier countries, rich countries have. But that doesn't take away from the fact that the old people still exist in these countries of the Middle East. They're still there. And many of them, as we know, live at home. They don't live in nursing homes. Now, that may be something you have to take into account. It is a tradition in the Middle East, and it comes, I think, from Islam, that old people are looked after by their family until they die, often in the homes they were born in. So you don't have this institution of sending people away from homes to places where they may become, in the case of a coronavirus, for example, they may become more vulnerable. So perhaps that's got something to do with it.
Yeah. Well, there are all sorts of theories that there might be some immunity left over from another coronavirus, the MERS coronavirus in 2012. There's the idea that when people people live in squalor, that those who survive in that squalor have fabulous immune systems, because otherwise they would not have survived.
I'm not sure that's a way of vouchsafing a good idea to have squalor. There is one other thing, Pat, and that is that up till the mid-19th century, there were regular visitations of the Black Death to Cairo. Napoleon had to deal with bubonic plague in Cairo after the French invaded Egypt. So these pandemics are not new to the Middle East in a way which they are comparatively new to richer countries, except for Spanish flu, of course, 1918, 1919. And since the Spanish flu, there's been nothing to compare with the Black Death, for example, in Europe or the West in general, whereas in the Middle East there was, and partly, I think, because of pilgrim routes, you know, China, Iran, Arabia, and Cairo. And it's interesting that when the Black Death first came to Europe, it's questionable whether it was the 15th, 14th century, it came on boats crewed by Italians, but many of them from the Middle Eastern region. There you go. I mean, it's a historical study worthy of many PhD theses.
Absolutely. Now, we know that Benjamin Netanyahu is facing trial on corruption charges. We'll talk about that in a moment. But his big political move is to take over huge tracts of Palestinian land. He's supported by Trump and Mike Pompeo in that regard. And it's putting it up to the EU as to, do we just sit on our hands and allow this to happen, or what can we do? You know, alienate ourselves even further from the Trump administration by facing down the Israelis, or capitulating?
Yes, I noticed your hesitation before you said capitulating. I think the European Union have been capitulating to Israel for a very long time. And when we refer to the vast Jewish colonies or settlements for Jews and Jews only on confiscated, seized, stolen Arab land, this is something that's already happened. What we're talking about is the promise or threat, depending on your point of view, by Netanyahu to actually, on or around July the 1st, set about the annexation, the legal or illegal, what many people would say, but in Israeli terms, the legal annexation of these territories and more. And this is going to be, or should be, a major turning point in the EU's attitude towards Israel, because over and over again, the EU has stated that the building of settlements, colonies, for Israelis, for Jews and Jews only, on Arab land is against international law. That is the general international view, except not in America now, as we know, under Trump. And if the European Union cannot abandon that. And every attempt it's made over decades now to say that this is wrong has been shot down by the Israelis, often with a good deal of abuse, saying that these European countries are basically anti-Semitic, merely for suggesting this. And of course, stating that that they're not seizing Arab land, that there never was a sovereign territory called Palestine. And if it was acquired by war, it was a war that Israel did not start, which is the case. That is the truth. The EU is in a very difficult position, and it's a highly sensitive one. And it's one that's constantly open to being misquoted, or the misquotation of prime ministers, politicians, diplomats, and journalists. And that is that the European Union, as we know, was founded as the European coal and steel community, and then as the European community, was founded on the basis that there should never be another war, primarily between Germany and France, again. And with the exception of Bosnia and Kosovo, that's largely been the case since 1945. And at the heart, at the core of this idea, is that you cannot acquire other people's land through war. And Germany did, both before the war and during it, if you think of Czechoslovakia, Austria, and Poland. Now, there is no comparison, there is no parallel between what Israel does and what Israel is, and the Nazis and Hitler. That is an anti-Semitic comparison and parallel. But there is a problem within this, in that the territories of the Arabs in which the Israelis are building, have built, and continue to build their settlements, was seized in war. The fact that the war, which is the 67 war, was begun by the Arabs is immaterial to the legal minds in the European Union, which say, hold on a second, if we accept this acquisition of land illegally, then what has happened to the foundational core of the European Union itself? And this is a big problem, because if the EU says, OK, we value the values of Israel, which Israel says are the law, justice, human rights, a law which can even put, let us speak frankly, a prime minister on trial on corruption charges, is this also a value? Is building your houses on other people's territory, is this also one of Israel's values that we're supposed to accept? And most people in Europe, including me, say no. That is unjust, and that is against international law. And this is the problem. But you see, the European Union, which signally failed to prevent war in Bosnia, it called it a civil war. It didn't want to get involved. It was the Americans who resolved Bosnia, remember, is in no position to suddenly stand up and say, we, the entire European Union, are going to levy sanctions against Israel or whatever it wants to do, when we know that some members of the European Union, I think of Hungary straight away or Poland, will veto such an idea. And thus we have the leadership of the EU now talking in very faint terms about breaking off one or two scientific relationships with Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that long ago when we had Solana actually saying that in effect, Israel was virtually inside the European Union already. And these things have, you know, this is a major problem which is out there and which will not go away, but which is almost unsolvable.
Now, the charges that he is facing, Netanyahu, are those of corruption. And in your piece in The Independent today, you talk about other charges that might have been taken against him and previous Israeli leaders for crimes much more heinous than corruption. But you muse a bit about corruption in the Middle East, whether it's Saudis or whether it's Israelis, yeah, or whoever it might be, that it's kind of endemic. It's just what we do. Thank you very much. And what's the big deal?
Yeah, well, I have a government department which is entirely mythical and fictional, Pat, but which I introduce into some of my reports. It's called the Department of Home Truths. It's things we don't really want to discuss and think about because it doesn't go along with the general drift of people's, you know, feelings, attitudes, policies, or anger. And that is that, yes, and I say at the very beginning of the article you're talking about, there are plenty of war crimes which Israel has been responsible for, Sabra Shatila massacre, 82. For example, the mass bombardment of Gaza, in which Hamas, remember, was also committing war crimes. So it's not really a sudden signal of the immense value of legality inside the State of Israel that on such comparatively minor charges, they're putting a prime minister on trial. But, and I use that word but in capital letters in my article, we haven't seen any prime ministers put on trial for corruption in the Arab world. Indeed, we've seen no leaders there arraigned for anything. When Israel actually held a commission of inquiry into the Sabra Shatila Palestinian camps massacre of 82 and held Ariel Sharon, then the defense minister, as personally responsible, that's the words it used, the Arabs in Lebanon, for example, carried out a brief government inquiry, which concluded after a few words that some people, it didn't even call them Palestinians, were killed by persons unknown. They didn't want to blame the Christian Falangist militia. And then one goes on from Sabra Shatila. Well, who was ever arraigned for the mass massacre at Hafez al-Assad's hands of the 10,000, 20,000 people of Hama in 1982, of Sisi's massacre, of the Muslim Brotherhood, of the massacres by Syrian military government bombers of Syrians in Hama or Aleppo or Homs or other cities. If you look around, of course, if the Arabs are thought to be allies of ours, Sisi, for example, Mohammed bin Salman, one hasn't seen him on trial for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. They're basically, there's no problem. If it's someone, a dictator we don't like or would like to see, you know, overthrown, like Bashar al-Assad, then we demand war crimes trials. But the fact of the matter is there are no trials of Arab governments or leaders of any kind. And against this, it is necessary to say, well, whatever the state of the values of the state of Israel, which I've just been talking about in terms of settlements, and there are many Israelis who do fear very much, including journalists like Amir Haas, that Israel is turning into an apartheid regime. There are still Israelis who believe very much in the idea of law and order, and they at least can still see in the trial of a sitting prime minister the idea that the law still exists inside the state of Israel in a way that it does not exist anywhere else in the Middle East. And that is a fact, and we journalists have got to acknowledge that, even though, you know, knowing what Israel has done to the Palestinians, it may not be easy to do so, but it's a fact.
On that slightly positive note, Robert Fisk, thank you very much for joining us. Fascinating insight into everything about Middle East.